Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Francine and Lynn welcome Dr. Gary Friedlander. Dr. Friedlander is Wayne O. Southwick Professor of Orthopedics at Yale School of Medicine, and he's here to talk about sarcoma. Here's Francine Foss.
Gary, can you start off by telling us what is sarcoma?
Sarcoma is a form of cancer. There are two huge areas of cancer. One is called sarcoma, which is primarily a disease of the support tissues of the body, the bones, muscles, ligaments, tendons, and other supportive structures, as opposed to the huge area of carcinomas. Probably carcinomas occur 100 times more frequently than sarcomas and are cancers of surface areas, cancers of the skin, cancers of the lining of our lungs, breasts, prostate, kidney, thyroid, GI tract, things of that sort.
It sounds like then sarcomas can arise from many, many different areas in the body.
They can. There are bones almost everywhere, and there are muscles throughout the body and the support structures that go along with bones and muscles.
And these sarcomas, Gary, they're soft tissue sarcomas and non-soft tissue sarcomas. Can you give our listeners a little bit more detailed information about those varieties?
Sure, be delighted. For what generally might be called the bone sarcomas, these are cancers that start directly in bone, and we usually lump those that start directly in cartilage as part of that group, as opposed to those that start in muscle, tendon, ligaments, blood vessels, fat, fibrous tissue, or the support tissue that's virtually everywhere in the body.
And can these problems occur in children as well as adults?
All ages.
Can you tell us how common sarcomas are?
There are about 11,000 to 12,000 new sarcomas diagnosed in the United States every year, compared to about 1.5 million carcinomas.
And are those equally distributed between the bone and the soft tissue?
Probably more in the soft tissue than bone.
And do most of those occur, again, in children or adults, or is it pretty much split even?
There are certain of these sarcomas that are characteristically found in a younger population, rhabdomyosarcoma, a cancer of muscle in kids, Ewing sarcoma, osteosarcoma, cancers of bone, typically found in young children, while there are some others that are more typical of middle age and older age.
Are there any risk factors, Gary, and are there genetic predispositions to any of these? Do you see it in families?
There are. You do see some of these in families. Risk factors come in a variety of categories. One risk factor that doesn't exist and is commonly misunderstood is trauma. I frequently will see people who recall an injury, draws their attention to their leg or their arm and helps alert them to something going on. But trauma per se, as far as we know, is not a risk factor for sarcomas. Things like radiation, things that we must do in order to successfully treat some forms of cancer, have a very small but clear risk of initiating a new sarcoma at a future date. There are some environmental factors that are associated with cancers in general. I'd be remiss in not pointing to smoking. It doesn't necessarily cause sarcomas as opposed to carcinomas, but environmental factors. There are some chemicals that we know have the ability to induce cancers in general. And then there are a variety of gene abnormalities, inherited gene abnormalities, that are also associated with cancers, including sarcomas, for neuroblastoma, and for rhabdomyosarcoma. There are also some individuals who have unfortunate gene abnormalities that make them predisposed to several different forms of cancer, Loeb-Prout-Mayne syndrome, for example. Gastrointestinal polyps, Gardner's syndrome, are associated with an increased risk of cancer. So there clearly are situations like that. Immunosuppression, relieving the body of its normal defense mechanisms, also seems to have an increased risk of cancer. And the story goes on and on. And we're learning more about that at places like Yale and our Smilo Cancer Center all the time.
Have you noticed a predisposition to certain parts of the body, more so in the arms, the legs, or in the trunk, or are things generally pretty evenly distributed when these sarcomas occur?
One of the things, the simple answer is that they occur all throughout the body. And that's one of the things that I'm particularly excited by in my opportunity to help people. I can help kids and more senior people. I can deal with problems in the arms, the legs, and everywhere in between. And in this age of super specialization, I have colleagues that concentrate on smaller areas of the anatomy and smaller parts of the population. So for me, that makes it even more interesting and more important.
Gary, you mentioned radiation as a potential risk factor. Can you reassure our audiences about, say, simple chest x-rays and kind of dental radiation? You know, people worry about that, and the question is, you know, is it justified to worry, and how often would you see a tumor like a sarcoma after just, say, like routine healthcare-related x-rays?
Thank you for letting me clarify that, firstly. The simple answer is that you never see cancer initiated after the routine kinds of x-rays that have become important to our health, the dental x-rays. And I get dental x-rays probably every couple of years, and don't worry about that at all. There is no reason to worry about that. You get more radiation in a chest in flying from here to Los Angeles by airplane than in a chest x-ray, if I recall that little factoid. And Dr. Wilson knows these better than I do. But simply put, no. The doses that are responsible for inducing new cancers are enormous compared to what we accumulate during our lifetime of normal x-rays. Part of it is the x-ray film and techniques, just like photography. We have faster and faster films for photography that require less and less light. We have new techniques in taking these imaging studies that require less and less radiation.
Gary, can we talk a little bit about how a patient presents with a sarcoma? What is the most common thing that you see when somebody walks in with a sarcoma?
Two possibilities, and sometimes both, a lump and pain.
And so they usually present, say, to a primary care for doctor or to another physician, I would presume?
Yes, both of those.
How do you know if you have to worry about a lump? A lot of people, you know, have various lumps, and people come to me as an oncologist, as a hematologist, for lymph nodes that are enlarged. When do you actually have to worry about a lump, say, that occurs in a muscle or on your joint or, you know, in another area of your body? When do you worry?
I think when you find a new lump, it doesn't mean automatically that it's a tumor. And there are benign tumors and malignant tumors. So if I start using the term tumor, some people will jump to the conclusion that's nasty. But to me, it's just a lump. Many lumps are injuries. You bang your leg on the desk, on, like me, on the bed frame from time to time, I might get a small lump. But that lump should go away rather quickly. So a new lump, and especially a new lump that enlarges, should be something you'd want to share with a healthcare professional and sort it out.
Are they painful usually?
Not always. You can't depend on pain being a sign of cancer.
Gary, Your role as an orthopedic surgeon, tell us a little bit what kinds of operations that you do, what sort of things are involved from the surgeon's perspective. Obviously, operating and removing the tumors, but what I'm getting at is talk to the audience about a lot of the planning that you think about that goes into these operations and why it's important for someone who's such a specialist such as yourself to actually perform the procedure as opposed to someone who may not have experience in sarcoma surgery.
Be delighted. First of all, why is an orthopedic surgeon a cancer surgeon? There aren't many of us, but those of us who have taken a special interest in this important disease get some additional training. It's built upon a complete residency training program in orthopedics, so I understand the musculoskeletal system. I understand the diseases and disorders that happen in bones, joints, muscles, parts of the musculoskeletal system. I understand how to operate on them, and more importantly, I understand when not to operate on them. It's much more important in terms of my daily life to decide when an operation is necessary and how to take care of the person after the surgery.
And what sort of planning goes into this? My understanding is it's not as easy as just doing a scan, seeing the tumor, and cutting the tumor out. I'm trying to get at limb-sparing procedures and what sort of geographical planning goes into your operation to try to maintain as much function as possible for the patient.
When one wants to remove a tumor, there should be an envelope of normal tissue surrounding it whenever possible and whenever it's required. When the lump, bump, tumor, lesion, whatever you choose to call it, is benign, that envelope can be very, very thin. And in fact, sometimes the envelope is not even necessary. As tumors get more active and aggressive, that envelope needs to be larger, thicker. And as that envelope expands, the potential for other important structures to be within that envelope, structures that would need to be traded in order to get rid of the tumor, become an important consideration. So part of my planning is to determine whether an envelope is necessary, how thick it is, what else is in that envelope, and what the consequences will be for the individual by removing those structures in exchange for getting rid of their aggressive tumor. When those trades are reasonable in terms of function, which they are most of the time, tumors can be removed without amputation. But there are some times when the envelope, the dotted line, include structures that just make a functional arm or leg impossible. And those are times that we have to strongly consider amputation, because what we're really trying to do is save someone's life. And there's a lot more to individuals' lives than an arm or a leg. Not that anyone wants to lose them, but sometimes you have to make a trade.
Gary, just one quick question. Are all of the sarcomas that you take out, are they all malignant, or are some of them not as malignant as others?
The word sarcoma implies cancer, malignant. And what makes a tumor malignant, as you well know, is its ability to spread to another part of the body. But having said that, there are, in addition to benign growths, which are not malignant, there are low-grade sarcomas, and there are high-grade sarcomas, and there are some in between. A low-grade sarcoma may behave in many ways more like a benign tumor than it does like a high-grade tumor, and the things that are required to treat it may be very, very different.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about sarcoma with Dr. Gary Friedlander.
There are over 12 million cancer survivors in the United States right now, and the numbers keep growing. Completing treatment for cancer is a very exciting milestone, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. The return to normal activities and relationships may be difficult, and cancer survivors face other long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the one at Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Today, we're joined by Dr. Gary Friedlander, and we're discussing sarcomas. Gary, tell us a little bit about the treatment team, some of the different treatment options that are involved in the management of patients with sarcomas. And you had mentioned a little bit about grade of the tumor. Perhaps comment on, does that have any influence on what sort of treatment program a patient may need?
The grade of tumor certainly does. It is critical that patients with aggressive tumors in particular have a team that's thinking about their individual problems. And that team goes far beyond any of us as individuals. And I think it's clear that we're colleagues and we work together all the time in teams, which are extremely important. The team, to me, involves a surgeon, maybe an orthopedist like myself. It may be a general surgeon or a surgical oncologist or any of the other surgical subspecialties as well. Medical oncology and radiation oncology kind of round out the trio of treatment modalities that we usually wind up discussing. But the team also includes the radiologist that helps us understand the imaging opportunities to define these tumors, where they are, what they look like, and the pathologist who helps us make these diagnoses. Many of these tumors are clarified by biopsies before we treat them. The way that biopsy is done can have a huge impact on how well we can treat them.
You had mentioned the radiologist. Are there particular scans, types of scans, that you find most helpful in the diagnosis of sarcoma, CT scan or MRI, or are you often using a variety of different types of imaging to really get a sense of the extent of the problem?
The imaging really has to be customized to the individual, and I think that's one of the great advances of cancer treatment in general and of centers like SMILO, is that individualization. There is this sense that because something is a new technique, that it applies to you as an individual, and it may or may not. There are things I used to do very frequently. An example would be traditional arteriograms or angiography, injecting dye into blood vessels. And we do that today, but we do it far less often because we have approaches like CT scans, like MRIs, like PET scans, and a number of evolving technologies like that. But just because somebody has cancer doesn't define specifically what the important imaging modalities are. It takes a team to decide what's in that patient's best interest, and they get what they need.
So, Gary, you talked about sometimes, unfortunately, the need for amputation or removing large parts of a limb. Can you talk about some of the new advances in limb-sparing surgery and some of the new advances, say, in prostheses if a patient has to have a limb removed?
Absolutely. One of the things I've really enjoyed over the years is my association with Ted Kennedy, and I don't think he would mind bringing his name up. But there is an example of an individual, and he frequently will come and talk, especially to children and teenagers that face this life-changing event, that it is not a life-ending event, that there is the ability with modern prosthetics to get back to doing a wide range of the very important things that people want to do, both professionally, educationally, and during their leisure time. It's very, very gratifying. It is enormously difficult on the front end to help patients realize how important this operation may be to their safety, their well-being on one side of that coin, and how much they're going to be able to do when all of this is done and behind them. And there are people who have gone through this who are very, very helpful in explaining this to people at a time of crisis.
And what about the various procedures that you have to, say, put in pieces of bone, if you have to take a piece of bone out, artificial substances that are now being used to help to rebuild these limbs?
Most bone tumors are benign, and many of them just require modest operations that don't affect the integrity of the bone, scraping out a tumor, and the body has the ability to heal, to regenerate its bone. But as tumors get more aggressive, more malignant, there are times you have to take out segments of the skeleton and even whole joints, large portions of bone, and we have a variety of ways of putting it back together, if you will. Sometimes it is putting in another piece of bone that's been donated by a generous individual at the time they pass away, just like kidneys, livers, hearts, lungs are also provided. They're screened very, very carefully to make sure that they don't possess any diseases and can be extremely helpful in reconstructing someone's skeleton. We also have a growing number of metallic and plastic implants. The designs are improving all the time. That can also be used to very effectively replace major parts of the skeleton and joints.
Do you ever have a circumstance where a person will donate, say, a piece of their own bone from one place of their body to go to another area?
Yes, and when that makes sense, it's done. It used to be far more common. What we've learned, and with the ability of new molecules that help the body regrow its bone, we depend on that less and less. Keep in mind that in order to take a bone or a part from one area and put it in another has some advantages biologically, but it has the disadvantage of being a second operation and removing something that has a function somewhere else. So more and more we're depending both on donated skeletal parts, bones in particular, and these new biomolecules that help the body repair itself.
Gary, getting back to treatment for a second, have there been situations where you were considering potentially doing an amputation for a patient, but you might consider incorporating pre-surgical radiation, for example, that might help obviate the need for an amputation? Does that ever happen? Can you sort of convert someone from a clinical situation where you think you have to do an amputation to possibly avoiding that?
Yes, I almost feel like you're a straight man in that regard because you've helped me out in that regard numerous times. And that's why the team approach is so critical. As you, as a radiation oncologist, learn better and better ways to more effectively irradiate some tumors. And as you know, some tumors are more responsive to radiation than others. And you're very knowledgeable and help me through those decisions. We often can convert a situation into an easier surgical procedure. And often that means limb sparing as opposed to amputation. Yes.
Gary, can you talk about whether there's a role for chemotherapy in the treatment of sarcomas?
I'm just trying to think of a word that expresses my awe and admiration to medical oncologists. The things that I get to do, and some of them have gotten extremely creative about sparing limbs, is really because medical oncology has improved so much over the course of my career, my 40 years doing this. And we've gone to a situation when I started of children with osteosarcoma, the most common form of bone cancer, having a survival rate of about 10% at 2 years, dismal, atrocious, to now where the vast majority of those people are cured. It's not a matter of a two-year survival. It's cured because of multi-drug chemotherapy. And that gives me the chance to do my limb-sparing tumor approaches so that those individuals who have been saved of their disease will also have a very functional life. So thank you.
You're welcome. Is it common for, say, the average sarcoma patient to expect to get chemotherapy, or is that only, say, in an exceptional case that you would give chemotherapy as part of your original treatment of the tumor?
It varies. Again, this is a team decision. There are clinical trials going on all the time to help us answer those questions even better. And there was a clinical trial that taught us that giving chemotherapy before surgery for osteosarcoma, what might sound counterintuitive to patients, turns out to save more people and increase their function. And there's a good reason for preoperative chemotherapy. What is dangerous about a malignant tumor is its ability to spread. And while I'm pleased with what I can do as a surgeon, just removing the tumor where it starts does not prevent the tumor from spreading. It's the chemotherapy that does that. And so preoperative chemotherapy followed by a well-planned surgical procedure and or radiation is often a superb decision. And these individualized options are the results of clinical trials.
In what cases actually would patients need chemotherapy later on? Say, if a patient, you know, has a metastasis, the tumor comes back, would it commonly be treated with chemotherapy, or would surgery be an option at that point?
Again, it could be both, or it could be radiation. And I can think of examples from the last few weeks that went each of those directions. Certainly, if cancer spreads, chemotherapy becomes even more important. And if they have had chemotherapy before the spread occurs, we now have more and more options of other drugs, just like germs. Some germs respond better to one antibiotic, some to another. The same is true of cancer. Cancer is not one disease. It's a huge number of diseases that share this feature of spreading.
Gary, can you comment about the follow-up program for a patient after they get an operation for sarcoma, for example? Because obviously the surgery might be very successful, tumors removed, but that's probably not the end of the process for a patient. And in fact, for some, it might really only be beginning at that point.
I have a wonderful opportunity to see patients back for years after their procedure for at least two important reasons. One is I want to make sure that the tumor doesn't come back where it was originally located. That's one of my primary responsibilities. With our team approach, the other aspect of their disease we want to keep watch over is whether the tumor shows up anywhere else. Sometimes I do that part of the job as well. Often my medical oncology or radiation oncology colleagues will play a role in that as well. So I wind up seeing patients, fortunately, for years and years after their original treatment.
Dr. Gary Friedlander is Wayne O. Southwick Professor of Orthopedics at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.